Aryam Shanti.
What's that? What's that?
That's a
relaxation prayer. Mm-hmm.
I could also pray. I thought maybe I should say
we're already recording, so.
Oh.
Rebecca is giving herself a relaxation prayer because she knows that we are about to talk about the conflict in Israel and Gaza. But let's introduce the podcast. My name is Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and professor, and this is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. Who are you, Rebecca?
I am Rebecca Bloom. I have a private practice in South Seattle where I specialize in adults with complex trauma. I've gotten my DNA tested. I'm 98.6% Ashkenazi Jew. I grew up in a liberal Jewish first generation West Coast family that had been a Chicago family for three generations, and previous to that came from the Ukraine and Poland, which I've learned was once the same place. So we're going to speak. I'm going to attempt to speak from my experience today. Should I just go for it? So we both know that we could receive hate mail for what's about to happen. I could lose friends. Kirk could lose friends. We could lose clients. You could lose sponsors. This issue cleaves people, cleaves groups, has for decades. So I'm going to read a post that I wrote on October 11th. I don't know when this is going to...
We're recording right now, October 24th.
Okay.
Just in case something happens between now and the time this gets posted that is relevant to the conversation.
And also, I'm going to ask Kirk the day this gets posted to give me some warning so I can mentally prepare for... So if you follow me on Instagram and you want to Instagram me your different opinion, just know that I probably won't write you back. I'm not here to convince anybody of anything. I'm just here to tell my story of how I got to my place and talk about what it's like having been for the last 2.5 weeks a Jewish therapist to Jewish clients who are all over the map, and supporting my Jewish friends and my activist friends and all the choices they've had to make. So here's what I wrote. On the 11th, which feels like a million years ago. All day I've been avoiding addressing the explosive conflict in Israel/Palestine because, one, old friendships will end when I express my opinion and I don't have it in me today. Two, because as an American Jew, I've been expected to have a formulated opinion on everything that happens there my entire life, and I don't have anything new to say. And mostly, I think all war, genocide, occupations, military-industrial complexes, killing and kidnapping of civilians are atrocious, and my heart is breaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's all you want to say?
No, I'll say more.
Okay.
I don't know.
I mean, I texted you last night, and I threw it out there because people have been emailing and wanting your opinion and us to talk about it. And I thought it'd be a good time since you're coming over today for us to talk about
it. Yeah. So I'll just say it's been a really rough time. I have supported people who have gone to the Capitol Rotunda and gotten arrested. I've supported people who are feeling more Zionist than ever and feel that Israel must be a Jewish state. And then I come home and I have my own opinions, which are formulated over a lifetime of experience. I mean, I had the experience I think most practicing Jewish American teens have. So I was born in 1970 and started my Jewish education at around 10. So it's 1980. And we were just, it was Jewish education, but it was also Holocaust 101 and a reminder that the Nazis were still coming to get us. And an indoctrination to Israel being a Jewish state was our only option to remain a Jewish people. Like, it was all so integrated into one giant clump that I can't even explain it to a non-Jew. And most Jews I know agree that their experience was the same. The only option was to be in a united front that we must have Israel as a Jewish state. And so I never questioned that. And at 16, I got the opportunity that many, many American Jews have, which is called a, quote, birthright trip, which has its own loaded issues with it. But I went to Israel with a bunch of other Jewish American teens. My trip was a little different in that it was a very small trip. There were six of us, and we stayed with Israeli teens who were about our same age in a town called Kiryat Shmona, which probably doesn't exist anymore. Those kids had all grown up in bomb shelters with the Lebanon war. And they were all like, Israel has to exist. And, you know, we sacrificed our childhood so that Israel could exist. So there was like this, just this constant dogma of like, oh, this is what we do and this is who we are. And by holding this land, we are a people. And then 2 years later, I was in college and just the way you do first year college, you're just introducing yourself to friends and getting to know people. And there was someone, oddly, who I'd gone to middle school with who was at my college, Alex Lubin, who's now a very well-known professor of, I believe, Middle East Studies and African-American Studies. And his mother was Barbara Lubin, who at the time was the most outspoken Jewish activist for Palestinian rights. And Alex turned to me and said, Israel is an apartheid state. And I just remember like my brain crushing as this is at the height of Ain't Gonna Play Sun City, you know, we will not support South Africa. Everyone kind of acknowledging that the politics of South Africa, a white minority dominating a black majority brutally, could not continue. And when he said that about Israel, I remember arguing with him and learning about him. And I think you should tag that article that I sent you about Barbara that really explains her lifelong activism. But I began to do my own research and I learned that Palestinians were extremely marginalized, treated as second-class citizens, forced to live on substandard land, brutalized by the police. Like, this is what I learned when I read up on the situation. And I said to myself, I can't go back. I, from what I just learned, I can't support. If I bring my American Jewish dollars to Israel, I know where they're going, and that's not okay with me. And because of the politics of things, and my own fear of friendships and support, I basically kept my opinions to myself. It is so complicated.
Well, what would happen to you if you were vocal?
I mean, at the time, I would lose friendships and get in arguments with family, and I didn't want to do that. My dad's wife, her parents are both, they're both blessed memory. They've both passed away now. They were both Holocaust survivors, and they met in a refugee camp in Europe after the war, and she was born in that refugee camp. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I definitely felt this working with the Vietnamese population, that there are some populations that understand genocide in a different way. Like, it is so close. And I think that's why I was able to stay at Asian Counseling for 2 years. I was like, surviving genocide? Hello. Like, this is not distant for me. This is like, you know, this has always been in my face. I've always known this level of complex trauma and intergenerational trauma and being on the run and losing everything and starting over. It's just been, if you are, your average Jew knows this inherently. But it was, for me, learn what I needed to learn about how Palestinians were treated in Israel. And then, it was mind-blowing. And I was embarrassed that as Jewish Americans, we just fall in lockstep. And like, it's made certain friendships really complicated. And I've lost friends. I remember I was looking at the history of this. It must have been in 2015. I just posted on Facebook about Israeli soldiers. See, you can hear my language. It's hard to talk about. Israeli soldiers shooting Palestinian children who were throwing rocks at them. And I just posted that this is an atrocity. And my friend, who I'd been friends with for decades in Israel, was like, you don't know the whole story. Those kids are paid to throw those rocks. And I wrote back, what kind of child takes money to throw rocks knowing that they might die? A hopeless child, an oppressed child, a child that doesn't have a future. And she wrote me back, I can't, our friendship is over. Because I live in Israel and I need Israel to exist, and your comments wipe out Israel to me. So there's this real sense in the Jewish community that if you say anything against Israel, you are being anti-Semitic. So it is like, it's one giant clump. And, you know, I think...
And certainly that's the case a lot of times, but not necessarily.
Yeah. And I think a lot of American Jews in the last 2 weeks have started to say, like, I'm having such a somatic reaction. My whole arm is, like, seizing up just talking about this.
What's your arm telling you?
It's like, we don't talk about this. Mm. We don't publicly say that we're not a united front because they will come for us and they will kill us. And I think a lot of American Jews are starting to say the way Israel treats Palestinians, you know, we have become the oppressor. And no matter what we live through in the Holocaust or what we live through to create Israel, this is not, I cannot support this. So I sent you an image of many, many progressive Jews in the Capitol Rotunda wearing, you know, not in our name t-shirts. And if folks want to track down the video from that protest, like, I've never been more proud in my entire life to see thousands of Jews risking getting hate mail from their own people to say, you know what, this isn't okay. And what do those Jews do when they got together? They sang. If you can track down the audio of thousands of Jews singing in the Capitol Rotunda, like, it's just like, oh my God, I could have never imagined this in my lifetime. But now I'm crying.
It must feel good to finally have people saying what you've been thinking.
Yeah, it's shocking. And I know, I mean, I all know what we will lose in doing this. I mean, I'm terrified for my dad to listen to this podcast. I don't want to fight with him about Israel.
Well, do you want to say what, or even if you have a solution to this? Because,
my God.
Because what I hear you saying, that people will hear you saying, is that you're saying Israel should go away.
I'm saying, what am I saying? I'm saying the military-industrial complex of Israel, it frightens me. It is a horrible war machine. They have already killed 4,000 people, and they will brutalize over the next 2 weeks. Thousands and thousands of people will die. That is not a country I can support. In any way, I have been attempting to read up because I knew you were going to ask this question. You should see my phone. There's like 5 tabs open on
of a solution. I mean, you don't have to have one. Right. I, as you're talking about this, I think people will think that you are suggesting something. Geez. I personally don't hear that. I don't know if you have a solution, but I can't imagine there being an easy solution.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if you saw a way forward.
The way forward is very complicated. So have I ever told you about the biggest fight I ever got in with my father-in-law, David? So we're on a cruise ship. We're at, like, one of those fancy, like, white tablecloth, like, dinners that they have at a cruise ship. And my mother and father-in-law were ardent Zionists, and Jimmy Carter is very active in Middle East peace process. And you know Jimmy Carter's a huge hero of mine. And he had come out with a new book or something, and I was trying to just talk about how Jimmy Carter was a hero of mine. And they just went off about how Jimmy Carter is not a hero because he supports the Palestinians. They're just going down this heavy-duty Zionist route. And I got up from the table and, like, yelled at David. And I was like, Jimmy Carter is a saint. And I walked out of dinner. So
short and sweet, fight.
I told you when I get mad, I'm just like, Aussie and I walk away.
Aussie. You Aussie David.
I know. I was like, so, I mean, I feel silly saying this. I mean, I pray for peace. I pray that there is a way that people can live on that land in peace and have different religious ideologies. Hmm. You know, if you follow the history of that place, thousands of tribes have crossed back and forth and had many, many religious views. And we've got two, you know, we're like, this is like two tribes go to war, right? Like, but it's like the war is so intense now.
Doesn't Jerusalem have prominent temples for all major religions, yeah, except for maybe Buddhism or something?
Yeah. It's, have you ever been there?
No.
I mean, it's amazing when you go there, you know, Christianity, Muslims, and Jews all share this as a holy land. All of their stories connect back to this place. And when you're there, you can feel it. Like, why? But it is, it brings this level of fervor and, you know, intensity that, like, it must be mine. So if I could change, and I can't change geopolitical landscapes, although I try in my mind, but I do try and change people's hearts. And, you know, if the idea was not this land comes out of my trauma, but like if we were to think, can this land be shared? Can this land be shared and not just trampled over? Can people be thoughtful? Can this not come out of religious fervor? I know this won't happen in my lifetime, but in supporting Eli in their process over this, I mean, we were joking, this is their first intifada when we are both adults and can talk about it as adults. And they have been doing tons of research. I've never been more proud of them. They've been schooling me in how in 1947, the British occupied this land and gave it to the Jewish people for a homeland without really, it wasn't theirs to give. Like, there are huge, you know, this is a colonial story. This is a story of oppression with many, many layers. So, you know, the common language for what I'm saying is there is a two-state solution. I don't even know if that, I don't have any answers. But floating in the ethos of all of this, a friend of mine who teaches marriage and family therapy was thinking about taking her students in the summer, in summer of 24. And I was trying to get on that trip to see what marriage and family therapy is like in Israel, due to the complex trauma of everyone there. That trip probably won't happen now. But it's funny because I told myself I'd never go back, right? And then there was this chance to maybe go back in a in my professional role. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've answered any questions.
I didn't know what you were going to say. Over text, you said a couple things that indicated something. But hearing you talk, I'm changed. It you know, has meaning and emotion and history and tears and pain and fear.
So much fear.
And injustice, obviously, for a lot of people over there, but for you to be attacked because of what you're saying. I mean, you're not, I think in my estimation, the injustice is often fueled by a misunderstanding of what people are actually saying when they're saying something. That unless you are on one side or the other, you're on the other side. You know, yeah. If you're not 100% on our side, then you're on the other side. And that's the hallmark of a lot of pain and tragedy. You don't get to that place overnight. You get there after centuries of oppression, right? On both sides, really. I mean, it's not like the Palestinians were doing well before Israel was created. So there's just generations of of death and genocide and harm and oppression.
And we're really fucking the same people. Mm-hmm. Like, we're really, you know, Semitic. The term Semitic is a linguistic term that includes, it's a linguistic term about language groups. And it puts Arabic and Hebrew together. Like, Semitic, I identify as a Semitic person. Today I'm wearing a hamsa, a sign of protection, for that is used throughout the Arab world. Jews use it, Arabs, Muslims, and Christians use this symbol.
Yeah, it's an eye with kind of an upside down hand.
Yeah.
And I've seen it in Turkey, I believe.
Yeah.
I haven't been to Turkey, but my dad had, and he brought one of those back for me.
Yeah, all over the Mediterranean, people use the same symbol. I am, as a 98% Ashkenazi Jew, my closest genetic relatives are the Turkish, or someone who's 100% genetically Turkish. Like, we are all actually the same. And I've been telling people this story all week about my time where I accidentally spent 3 weeks in Croatia. Have I told you this story?
I remember when you went to Split, right?
Yeah. And if anybody's listening from Croatia, we'd love to hear your version of this story of genocide. So the story happens all over the world. So when we're in Croatia, you know, after you're there for a while, you realize there's all these like kind of abandoned buildings, like in the middle of a town, there'll just be like a building that's been untouched for like decades. And it's like, did that get bombed in the war or what happened there? And someone will say, well, that was a Serbian family. And when they left, no one will touch it now. Or you'll find a graveyard that's been completely untouched for decades, and the stones will be in Cyrillic, and you realize, oh, this was a Serbian grave. This is a Serbian graveyard. So I'm starting to ask people, like, what's going on? And they said, well, you know, we've been fighting, Croatians and Serbs have been fighting for a long time. Oh, how long? Well, this fight started in the 1100s when the Roman Orthodox and the Russian Orthodox Church split, right? Like, and I was like, oh, I know this. This kind of entrenched battle between two people who look exactly the same and happen to have different religious ideologies, right? Like, you see it in the Troubles in Ireland, right? Like, two people that look exactly the same and have different ideologies and will kill each other into oblivion, right? You know, I mean, this happens all over the world. And so I just, if this struggle makes no sense to you and you have any of those ethnic histories or, you know, North, South Vietnam, same deal. So yeah, you know, we do this as people. I don't know why we're programmed to kill each other like this. Like, it's so painful. Why do we do this?
Yeah.
So if you know nothing about what's happening, and you're on Patreon, we'll put some of the links there in this discussion. But my hope in coming on today and doing something, I think this is like the risk. I've done some crazy risky stuff on this show. This by far for me felt like the riskiest.
Is this the first time you've cried as well?
Well, we did that patron-only episode on my childhood trauma. I must have cried.
In my head, must have, but I there's a chance that... I mean, I couldn't really see you that well because you were on the ground across my office, and I had to look under my table to see you. And you were under a big down blanket. But
I should have done this podcast like that.
Yeah.
That would have made more sense.
But when I texted you, I thought you would say, oh boy, I don't think it's a good idea for us to talk about it. And you said, basically, fuck it. Let's go for it. And I said, okay.
Well, and I am inspired by one of my clients who also said, fuck it this week and just went all in against. And, you know, it's gotten hate mail and is pretty freaked out. But I was like, damn, this is the time. And that this is the time to have dialogue about real people's stories and really listen to each other. This struggle doesn't get any better if we just stay in our silos. This is a time to listen to each other and figure out why that person got super Zionist and that person got hella pro-Palestinian, and, you know, the only way stuff like this gets better is if we can somehow sit down and listen to each other's stories and just listen. And share food and try and see each other's humanness. And this doesn't get any better if I lose friends. Not me personally, but, like, you know. And this doesn't get any better if you send me a death threat because I said my opinion today. Like, that is just perpetuating what this is, which is sheer blinding hate. It's just, yeah, that's what this is. And I think that's what you and I are really against. We are pro nuanced dialogues where people mess up and make mistakes and learn from each other. And, you know, I'm like profoundly impacted that you've learned something today. Like, I didn't expect that.
Yeah. Being a couple therapist, a family therapist, that'll train that into you, because if you are a good therapist, you care about everybody in the room, and you spend the time to be in their shoes. You might have a harder time relating to some people more than others, but you can see both people coming from a place of fear and resentment and potential dehumanization of the other. You don't get there because you choose. You get there because something happened, and then both people just go after each other, and it's my job to help them to see a third way. And it feels like these kind of conflicts would benefit from having some kind of collective relational therapy of some sort. I thought the same thing when Putin invaded Ukraine. I just thought he's afraid of something. He's afraid. He's afraid of NATO. He's afraid of losing territory. He's afraid of losing power. He's afraid of losing influence. And
Netanyahu is the same. He is a leader afraid. You can see that in his politics leading up to this, where he tries to create this super crazy non-democracy. Last month, this month, this invasion happens, and he comes out guns a-blazing, very publicly saying, I will now obliterate the other side.
Yeah, I saw that speech. And I just think if someone could just bring everyone to the table so that people aren't so afraid, maybe this can be solved. But there's seemingly no effort along those lines, at least visibly to me.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a Jewish-Palestinian peace attempting for decades.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it is on the shoulders of Jews to allow someone else's oppression and trauma to be equal to theirs. I would say the thing that Jews do really well is it is the reason that other people don't like us, is that we say my trauma trumps everyone else's trauma. Our trauma has been so horrific. We get to the front of the line of the trauma world. And I think for me, the work of the modern Jewish person is to say, my trauma informs my experience, but my trauma is no more or less than anyone else's trauma. And so if, you know, the Jews who I see who are doing the work where they can sit with and understand and see the trauma that is being brought onto the Palestinians can have that nuance in their experience.
Yeah, and I just, you say that death threats and people will attack you and me. I just don't understand that. I'd love to know if you have an impulse, dear listener, to attack either one of us. I would love I'd love to be given an opportunity to be convinced of the premise, because there's a chance that I deserve to be attacked. I don't know. But the typical attack won't allow for that chance for me to learn anything, you know? So if there's something that I should learn, then by all means. I don't know much about this situation. I know more, I believe, than the average person, but that doesn't say much. the average American anyway. There's a lot of detail, and hearing you talk, it's really deepened, you know, my understanding of the emotions and the history and the considerations, you know, and the context, the soup. You know, if you were just left to have an opinion, that would be one thing. But given where you come from and the world you live in and who you are and your family, and it just changes things.
Yeah. And Eli, I wrote them and said, hey, I just want to give you a heads up. I'm doing this. And is there anything that you would want me to share with people? And they were like, some group has, I'll just bring it up because it was such a great thing, such a sweet thing that they wrote me. I said, you know, hey, I'm doing this. This is how I got to my opinion. And they wrote me back. Amnesty International has a 250-page document outlining their investigation into Israel as an apartheid state. And then they wrote, please be careful with what you say. Think about the intensity of the comments that you got about whether or not you were pro or anti-bisexual in the last podcast I did. This is an issue of life or death for thousands. And I was like, yeah, like this is, people get so into my people may be obliterated by what is said next that we cannot hear each other. And that's when messed up things happen, right? That's when we're not breathing. That's when we move really impulsively. And, you know, that's why thousands of Jews descended on Washington, because they were like, you know, things are moving really quickly. I mean, there is a call right now for a ceasefire. Like, hey, people with unbelievably ballistic gun power that can obliterate buildings, just chill just for a minute.
Well, thanks for having the courage to talk.
Thanks for this amazing venue. I hope that people can slow down and listen. I hope that if you flooded at any point in this conversation that Kirk and I just had, like, just take a couple breaths, take a walk around the block, just let yourself sit with these huge feelings. This fight is huge. I've also been reminding people this is relentless. And also there's this thing happening on the left where it's like, don't turn a blind eye, and people feel like they have to watch the coverage relentlessly. And I would just remind people to be trauma informed. And if it is keeping you up at night, if you are sobbing for hours on end, you have seen enough and you're allowed to turn it off. You don't need to, you know in your heart what's happening, and your brain literally cannot process the level of violence that's occurring. If you are having, I mean, people are describing to me having post-traumatic stress symptoms and feeling like they still have to watch. And so I'm just encouraging people to be trauma-informed and know that you've seen enough, you know in your heart what's happening.
Yeah.
Please turn it off.
Yes. There's a impulse that when we are in threat, under threat, in danger, to turn towards the threat. It makes sense that we evolved that way. We're in a cave and there's a noise in the darkness. You don't just ignore it, you turn toward it. If someone in your tribe 200,000 years ago is being attacked, you want to look at it because you might have to do something about it, and or it gives you information as to what the threat actually is so you can save you and yours. Given the way the internet works right now and TikTok and all the algorithms, the more you click on this stuff, the more it's going to pop up and you're going to keep turning. And then it's a feedback loop where you watch the clip, you become more terrified, which causes you to turn to more clips, and the algorithm just feeds you. And it's not healthy. It is the opposite of healthy and absolutely can create PTSD. So it's important that you listen to your body. As Rebecca was saying, you can know something and be an activist or have it on your mind or pray, all the things. You don't have to be putting all these images into your head. There's only so much a mind can handle. I would argue that just one of the images out of millions is
plenty.
Is plenty. Yeah. So And it doesn't mean that you're ignoring the problem. It doesn't mean that you're complicit with the problem. It just means that you're protecting yourself. And you're not going to do the cause any good if you're crying yourself to sleep in a fetal position every night and causing you to cut yourself off from your relationship and from humanity. That's not going to help you. So, yeah, absolutely take care of yourself. All right, Rebecca. Well, thanks for talking about that. Let us know, dear listener, what you think in the comments. Be kind to Rebecca. Be kind to each other. I think that's the main request here and the main philosophy that Rebecca is trying to promote.
And tell your story of how you got to your... How you got where you are.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Not I have to convince you to think like me. Like, hey, here's how I got to where I am.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I want to know you.
Yeah. Everyone out there, please, truly, and everyone who's not listening, take care of yourself and take care of others. Why should they do that, Rebecca?
Because this is a slog. This is a marathon. So really, if the day-to-day things you do to ground yourself are going to keep you going through this.